Good day, folks. Welcome and thank you for tuning in today. You are listening to Red Ice Radio, the one and only, recently censored and removed from iTunes, and proudly so. I'm Henrik Palmgren from Sweden, and on our website, redicecreations.com, you can follow our program. We do three new shows each week. We have archives going back to over a year. We have the full archives all the way back to 2006 on redicemembers.com. We feature interviews, research, and analysis with the objective of questioning the official version of what we're getting from the media, our governments, and the talking heads, politicians, and officials that are seeking our complete ruin. Our goal is to cover the most interesting researchers that speak about many of the most important issues. We, of course, seek accuracy and truth, and we do talk with a lot of different people, and we do not always agree with everything our guests say. But, you know, we also like to have conversations and talk with folks that we might not always see eye to eye on regarding every single issue. This is also investigations designed to determine the validity of material, research, and claims. I also want to say thank you, by the way, for all the nice emails and the positive feedback. We try to get back to as many as we can, but it is difficult since we're so busy producing and researching here. But we love to hear from you, so please stay in touch and keep sending us your emails. Today, we're talking with Mike King from Tomato Bubble. Mike is a private investigative journalist and researcher based in the New York City area, a 1987 graduate of Rutgers University. King's subsequent 27-year career in marketing and advertising has equipped him with a unique perspective when it comes to understanding how public opinion is indeed scientifically manufactured. Madison Avenue marketing acumen combines with the city boy instinct to make Mike King a tenacious detector of things that don't add up in the world today. On his website, you can find a lot of interesting material, and he has an uncanny ability to ferret out and weave together important data points that others miss. Some of the other interests of Mike King include the animal kingdom, philosophy, chess, cooking, literature, and history, with the emphasis on the events of the late 19th through the 20th centuries. Well, we have a couple of interesting topics lined up today. We'll begin speaking about the targeting of the Yazidis in Iraq or Kurdistan by ISIS, and how their existence is threatened because of how they look. We'll continue on the trail of World War II history, picking up on the greatest story never told line of questioning and try to get closer to the truth about the rise of National Socialism in Germany and how we can understand what really happened outside of the bubble that 70 years of Allied propaganda have created for us. Mike, hey, welcome. Thank you so much for coming on. Good talking with you today. Hope you're doing well.
Yeah, hello, Henrik. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Great. This is going to be a lot of fun. I came across your website not too long ago, bumped into some really good articles on the, you know, the Yazidis, and I realized that you were writing quite a bit on some of the, psychology behind, you know, conspiracy. You're writing about World War II history, about Russia, about a lot of different topics. But your website has an interesting name, Tomato Bubble. Tell us about the name and how this came about.
Sure. That question comes up often. It's an accidental name for the site, in a sense, because the site began years ago. One of the very first pieces posted was the allegory of the Great Tomato Bubble. So it's an allegorical tale which describes our monetary bubble economic system that is plaguing the world. So that's called the Great Tomato Bubble, the allegory of the Great Tomato Bubble. So the site took its name from that. And in time, it just began to take a different direction. Although I post many pieces dealing with economics still, but the main focus, as you can see, is history, conspiratorial history, with an emphasis on World War II, and also current events and a touch of philosophy. But the name tomatobubble.com came from that original story, which you'll see posted there on the left.
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of interesting topics on your website and a lot of things we wanted to go to. Now, the main kind of thing I stumbled across, we had one of our prior guests send us an article on the Yazidis and actually their situation in Iraq. And I thought it was interesting as well because we had in Sweden, we've had a large Kurdish community. We've been very helpful in getting the Kurds into Sweden because of the horrible conditions that they've been subjected to. In Iraq, it's been a lot of fights for a long time, and I'm really glad to see that we were in a position where we could be able to help them, you know. And of course, we hope that things you know, improve in their country, right? So that one day they can return and they can, you know, be in their homeland, because it's going to be difficult to be away from it. But what Sweden has accepted a lot of Kurds, but for some reason, the on the issue of the Yazidis, this hasn't been as prominent. I think today, actually, numbers are from 2010. I think it's they say it's grown to around 4,000, which is not that much if you compare it to the other other population. What do you know about the Yazidis, and what is their plight? How have they been, you know, targeted? And what, in your view, what are some of the background between some of these fights that are, have been going on in this region between these different ethnic groups, Mike?
Well, what's interesting is, although I consider myself fairly well-informed and well-read about events and peoples in that region of the world, I had not learned of the Yazidis just until 2 weeks ago, when this so-called ISIS gang began killing them. And I mean, I think it's obvious as to why no one has ever heard of the Yazidis, and that is there exists a worldwide conspiracy to suppress the truth of the great Aryan peoples that once populated all of Central Asia, as far east as Central China. And what I learned, it really shocked me, that this Yazidi minority, they've married amongst themselves over the centuries, and they look as Nordic as any Swede or German or Norwegian. I mean, they are blonde-haired, blue-eyed, many of them are. They're red-haired, green-eyed. So they're straight-up white folk. And that explains why they're being targeted for genocide by this ISIS gang, which I maintain is a front for CIA and Mossad activities.
Yep.
And I think it also explains why countries like Sweden and other European nations perhaps have not been so accommodating in accepting them. Because, as we all know, the purpose of immigration in Europe is to replace the natives, the European white natives.
Yep.
So they certainly don't want to bring in blonde hair and blue-eyed.
It's defeating the purpose, isn't it?
Sure.
Yeah, we've had some numbers. Denmark has about 500. Sweden has about 4,000. So it's something. I'm not. I mean, we shouldn't be that unfair to say that it's nothing. But in Iraq, there is about, or total population is about 700,000. So this is a small minority. And I think about 650,000 of them are still in Iraq. But they also have an interesting, I don't know how much you know about this, but we have, the Yazidis has been coming up a little bit in some of our past shows, because their religious ideology is very interesting. It's been deemed to be satanic by some of the other religions in the area, that they have, that basically they're devil worshippers, right? They're one of their main what should you call it, angels or whatever, is a peacock symbol that they use and everything else. So it seems to be an older tradition that stems from somewhere, an older, I shouldn't say pagan, perhaps. It seems to maybe be a little bit more Gnostic or something like that. But yeah, they've definitely been targeted. What do you think is going to happen to them, Mike?
Well, I believe in time, as Iraq disintegrates, which is the plan, they'll probably be targeted to be blended out. I mean, we're hearing stories now of hundreds of Yazidi women having been kidnapped and being sold. And these ISIS radicals are openly saying that they intend to smash their blonde haired bloodlines. So I don't know if it will be a straight up genocide that could happen, or it could just be a forced blending out of the bloodlines. But there's no question that they've been targeted by this Mossad CIA front organization known as ISIS, because this hatred for the Aryan peoples amongst the hardcore Zionists goes back centuries, millennia, and I believe they will never be satisfied as long as there's one blonde-haired, blue-eyed, redhead person on the face of this earth. And I say that as someone who's three-quarters Italian and deriving my Irish last name from one grandparent. So I'm not, I received some email feedback from that piece I wrote, people suggesting that I'm a Nordic supremacist and I don't consider other Europeans European. So wait a minute, pal. I'm 5'9", brown hair, brown eyes. I could probably fit into any European country. You wouldn't think of me as a Nordic by any stretch. Although certainly all whites have been targeted, but in particular, the hatred for the Nordic is really intense on the part of our Jewish supremacist friends.
Why is that? What does this go back to? We've touched upon this with other guests, and it's always interesting to philosophize a bit and why that is. It's something that's kind of slowly been kind of, you know, creeping out. It's become more and more, you know, obvious to see it, and also the our detractors are getting more and more vocal and loud and quite open about it too, for that matter. But what's the root of this, do you think?
I believe the root is twofold. One of it being just straight up envy. You know, you look at the Nordic European peoples and what they accomplished, and even just their physical appearance, being taller and fairer, and I have to say more physically attractive in a general sense. I think that triggers an insecurity in certain other races. So that's a big part of it. And then the other element, too, is if your goal is world domination, there's really only one people out there that can stop the Jewish supremacists, and that is, you know, your European, Northern European. In their view, they see that as their greatest obstacle as a people. And years ago, I've got a quote in one of my books that I dug up from Benjamin Disraeli, a former Jewish prime minister of Britain in the 19th century. He wrote a fictional account in which he's one of the characters is supposed to be Nathan Rothschild. And he's quoting Nathan Rothschild about the blending out of the persecuting races. And by that, obviously, he means the Nordic race. So
right.
Part of it is a turf war. The Jewish supremacists would like to remain the only Caucasian in town. And they feel that they could more easily lord over a browned out race, a global race.
Wow, talk about being racist, huh?
Oh, it's the ultimate racist. It's about envy, it's about power, and it's been going on for a millennium. And I think one has to be blind not to see. I mean, the hatred for the white people is palpable now. There's been some recent events in America. It's just, and even many white people are waking up to the reality. Unfortunately, they never see the string pullers above the cloud line.
Right. Yeah, it's quite extraordinary, actually, and it's been going on for a long time as well. I mean, we can take this into the modern times a little bit and talk about some of the examples later, but let's go back a little bit more in time. It's always interesting. We did a show on the Guanches, the white Indians of Navarra, which is a very other interesting story about a kind of a Berber people on the Canary Islands, very native, living in kind of, the guest we had on, Gordon Kennedy, spoke about this as they're living in kind of Eden-like conditions and everything, very kind of, kind of part of the philosophy of like the noble savage, that kind of idea, you know, but how they were targeted by, you know, the Spaniards and the other, European peoples that were in the expansionist phase. And again, I think that this was more to do with religion as opposed to anything else. I think consequently, history, people have been looking back and they think that it's been a European oppression against all other peoples on, let's say, racial lines. But I don't see it like that at all. I see it's rather maybe some religious background or some other kind of things that, you know, they've been used to a certain extent. But if we look at it historically, you brought up in your article that you had on the Yazidis about, for example, you know, the Cloud Warriors, the Chachapoyas. There are other examples of older tribes that seems to have been specifically targeted. And I don't know if they've been driven to you know, kind of these extreme environments like up in the mountains or if they came from there. We really don't know which direction that occurred. But nonetheless, it means that it seems like there's been a targeting over a long time of chasing out these people, for the lack of a better term. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's just a constant in our human psychology, this deadly sin of envy, one of the big seven deadly sins. And it just seems that whenever you have these Aryan peoples in proximity with other races, tends to trigger a certain insecurity in those races and an envy that in its most extreme forms can manifest in a violent manner. we see this time and time again all over the world. And, you know, one could dismiss one story perhaps as the stuff of legend, but when these tales keep coming up again and again and again, it's clear to me that we're not dealing with mythology so much as we are with oral histories that have been transmitted. We see this with the Mayans. We see this with the, I forget the name of that white tribe in the northern Japanese islands. There's a legend among the Lakota Indians in western United States about having killed out a white tribe. It comes up over and over and over again. History repeats itself. And I maintain it has to do with just the envy of seeing what these people build and the realization that your people have not done this. So you want to destroy it. Well, we go back to the Mongol invasions of India. The ancient Indian civilization was established by Aryans. They had great universities and libraries. The Mongols came in and destroyed everything for no reason. So, I think the other aspect of this too is that one of the greatest virtues of the Aryan people is simultaneously a vice, and that is the good nature and the trusting heart, I think, opens them up to be taken advantage of and abused. I just have a feeling that even in ancient times, that these other races were helped and the benefits of civilization were introduced to them, and then at the end they just threw it back in their face and killed them off. But there's evidence of this all over the world.
Yeah, I encourage people to read your article to get the full background. We're going to have it linked up on our website on the program page here. Take a look at it because it goes into some of the people we've talked about, like Barbara Spector and others that have been coming up before. We recently linked up the distinguished alumni from Harvard University there as well, Noel Ignatiev, slaughtering his name there. But, and you know, it comes through in people like Sigmund Freud and other people as well who are, Albert Einstein, these very prominent people who are raised to the highest within academia and, psychology and everything else. So it's not something that's it's not a delusion. It's quite openly these days. And I'm still very surprised that there isn't more, backlash on this when it's so open in this regard, because, I mean, who else could be targeted in this way and can quite openly? If you look at Noel's comments, he's talking quite openly about how to, end the white race. Who else could be sitting at a prominent university and talk like that, you know?
Yeah, and it's an interesting double standard. There was recently a case of an academic in America. I don't recall the university or his name, but this happened a couple weeks ago. He put out a tweet condemning Israel. It was kind of a harsh tweet. I mean, nothing overtly bigoted or anything like that, but I mean, he was gone.
Yeah.
Within days. So.
Yeah, there you go. Now let's talk about ISIS a little bit more. I want to get your take on what actually is going on there. I don't know how much you've been watching the story, but another interesting aspect to this is, of course, we've had a lot of outpouring from Europe now, a lot of among the immigrant population in Germany, in France, in even Norway and Sweden as well. People go down and fight in some cases for ISIS, in some cases against ISIS, which is quite interesting. Germany had several demonstrations, the pro and the con, and now the German people are standing on the sidelines, is watching this madness while the police and the country are left to deal with the the police enforcement and the legal issues and the, fees and everything else that this is drawn into. It's quite interesting how this kind of conflict is spreading to a lot of the other parts of the world. It's like taking the Middle East issue and bringing it to a global stage. And ISIS is certainly helping in this scenario as well. Just look at how the U.S. have treated this in their mainstream media and the way that they're hyping this up as well, you know?
Yeah, well, everything is going according to plan with ISIS. I mean, as you recall, a year ago, we came very close to going to war with Syria, which would probably have morphed into also a war with Iran. And it was Mr. Putin and his Chinese ally that shut that down, as you will recall. So it was back to the drawing board, and Plan B was to bring out of nowhere, this spontaneous army called ISIS, which we are to believe just materialized and equipped itself and organized itself and financed itself completely under the radar screen of the NSA, which records every phone call and email on the planet, and underneath the radar of the CIA and the Mossad and the British intelligence and so on. So, you know, the thing is phony. You know, it doesn't mean that all the fighters are phony. Typically, the way these things go is you have the leadership is controlled by intelligence operatives and their mercenaries. And you probably have a bunch of criminals freed from prisons and maybe some true believer Islamic radicals who've latched onto it. But this is a tool that is serving Israeli interests, Israeli and Western interests. And the purpose is to once again draw the United States into Syria under the pretext of fighting ISIS. And while we're in the neighborhood, I'm sure that we'll drop a calling card on Mr. Assad as well.
God, yeah. Well, it's a dodgy situation because it could go into, I mean, Syria obviously is going to look at this as an aggression. And he's been, as far as I've been able to tell, fairly accommodating so far. He says, yes, we want to try to, you know, deal with this issue. We do accept help and everything, but he's clearly said you can't just like send in fighter jets that's going to drop bombs on our country. That's going to be seen as an aggression, and things could deteriorate or escalate rather fairly quickly in a situation like this. I wonder what Russia is going to do in the situation and how Iran is going to put themselves across in this place as well, you know?
Well, it's an interesting chess match because simultaneous to this, and not by coincidence at all, we've had the events unfolding in Ukraine, where these same Jewish neocons played the leading role in toppling a Russian-friendly government and installing this gang of criminals that has just been relentless in its attempts to provoke Mr. Putin into invading Ukraine. So we have to keep an eye on there, but it's clear that the name of the game is to somehow bog down or at least preoccupy Russia with the prospect of a war or maybe an actual war in Ukraine. And this could create an opening. Syria would lose its Russian protector if they're busy somewhere else. And the same game is being played with China over in the Far East. The American puppet was president of Japan right now, continues his provocation of China. Same with these little puppet states, Vietnam, Philippines. So this encirclement policy of the two Eurasian giants, who ironically years ago were the red menace of planet Earth, today are the last hope for peace in this world.
It's so strange. It's such a bizarre situation, but it's it's quite interesting. It's we've talked about this idea of the cultural, you know, Marxists that did win the Cold War per se, and that the force really of internationalism or globalism, which kind of has taken a lot of different expressions, but nonetheless within this, if we look at, for example, how America and Europe as well now, from the official level at least, are pushing things like, you know, political correctness very strongly on other countries, etc. They're very domineering in how, you know, countries should have the type of democracy that they have, etc. It's it could be argued that Cold War was won on by the academic level, and now this is the expression that we have today in 2014, that a kind of an international hybrid between, you know, the global banking system and a kind of a version of Marxism really is what's being imposed on the rest of the world. And now Russia is fending, you know, trying to fend off that, and they're you know, kind of in a position of representing some kind of orthodoxy and conservatism to a certain degree. Very bizarre situation, isn't it?
It certainly is. I mean, I've studied, I've actually authored a book, which you can find on the website or through Amazon, The War Against Putin. But I dig into some of these matters, and in researching it, I was pleasantly surprised to learn of some of the things I did about Russia. It's very business friendly, has the lowest tax rates in Europe. They've instituted mandatory morality and ethics training in the schools. Children are free to pray in the schools. They rebuilt cathedrals. They've limited abortion. There's no question that Russia is rediscovering its conservative roots in so many ways. And this, I mean, Putin is even encouraging Russian women to have babies. I mean, he gave a speech earlier this year. He said, "I am convinced that the norm in Russia should be to have three children." I mean, where are you hearing this in the West, which is depopulating?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, so, it's pretty amazing.
You know, anyone who thinks, I mean, you hear the propaganda here in the United States coming from the neocon circles about Putin being a commie, Putin's former KGB. I mean, what fools? I mean, this man is a cultural, conservative, pro-business, nationalist patriot. One would think the Republicans would love him in America. But somehow they're stuck in that Cold War mentality. And, you know, even China, I learned that 20% of the membership of the Chinese Communist Party, which is basically a misnomer at this point to say China is communist, but it's like 20% of the Communist Party, their members practice some form of religion. So even in China, there's a rediscovery of sanity. But here in the West, it's an absolute free fall into hedonism and degeneracy. And we look eastward now if there's to be any hope of restoration of what we used to call Western civilization.
Yeah, yeah, it's very sad. Now, how about in Russia there? Did they ever go after homosexuals there, or what was the deal there?
Well, the true story there, I mean, of course, if you listen to the Western propaganda, one would get the impression that the homosexuals were being dragged out of their homes in the middle of the night and sent to the gulag or something.
Yeah.
But in reality, they have passed laws that, one, forbid these gruesome spectacles of gay pride parades going down the street, which I'm sure most Americans would not want that in their hometown, I assure you. But the crux of their so-called anti-gay law is you cannot proselytize or propagandize children. Okay? I mean, you could engage whatever acts you want to in your bedrooms with your buddy, but stay away from the kids. So that's all there is to this legislation. So but that's been misrepresented here in the West as some sort of persecution.
Right. Yeah, I think someone tied it back to one article out of the New York Times, of all papers, of course. But and this spread like wildfire afterwards. It was basically reprinted in different capacities, rewritten a bit, but published all over the West, basically. And I was like, finally, we have something on them. We can, you know, we can pressure them on this. And it turns out, as you said, it was completely inaccurate. Actually, the accusations against Russia and against Putin as well. As opposed to, of course, what's happening here in the West, where kind of, from my perspective, sexuality and things like that are pushed on young children way too early at a time when they, things that they shouldn't really be worried about at that age, rather. And again, it's kind of a reverse situation where it's kind of very much encouraged. I always go back to that Huxley quote who talks about how, you know, as state tyranny, basically, I'm paraphrasing here, but a state tyranny increases the steam valve of the culture, or the dictator, he says, actually would do really good at increasing and promoting sexuality as a kind of a steam vent, as a way to get some of this pressure out. And I mean, my God, can't we see that in the West right now, and everything on the TVs and everything? It's very, everything
Absolutely.
Is over sexualized, you know?
Well, you know, a self-indulgent, decadent, depraved populace will be incapable of recognizing right and wrong, not just within their own behaviors, but in the policies of their rulers. You see, if you intend to govern as a tyrant, you're better off having a degenerate people who don't really care about virtue or what's right and wrong or civic duty. They just care about, you know, their sex and their drinking and their entertainment. So it's a big diversion, and it's not by accident. I mean, you look at every country where, as soon as the left became a powerful force, you instantly saw this degrading of the traditional virtues and an opening of sexuality. So the two go, they definitely go hand in hand. The tyrant fears a virtuous, industrious, disciplined, pro-family public.
Yes. Yep, exactly. We're actually watching some new pilots, some TV episodes, just to kind of get a flavor of what people are getting out there and what's going on at the stage with entertainment and everything else. And it was just like a barrage of just mindless, empty filth, really. It was just full of, in the first like 10, 15 minutes, it was just full of, you know, masturbation and blowjobs and drugs and everything. And again, I'm not a prude. I don't care if, you know, people do this in their own homes or whatever, but it's like, is that the values of what people are looking at on the TV now for entertainment? What happened to striving for something bigger and higher and excellent and taking pride in what you do and you know, role models and heroism and good deeds? I mean, God, we're so far down on that scale, you know?
Yeah, it's, you know, even if a great leader were to emerge, I mean, to reverse the damage that has been done to our civilization, I mean, you're looking at least a generation, at least.
Now, there's been some, let me ask you about porn a little bit. I know we're kind of jumping back and forth a little bit, but we're kind of just going where the conversation is going here, really. But there's been some quotes pulled out in terms of the rise of the porn industry as well, in terms of how this was kind of done as a revenge against, well, from that perspective, the Christian West, really, that there was as an antagonism against that. And one of the ways to try as an effort to kind of break that down is to have an over sexualized culture, but also kind of extreme pornographic or access to pornography. If we look at how the web has developed in that way, where I guess it's what's still one of the most popular destinations online, right? It's the porn websites and everything else. What part is this in this, do you think? And the elite, how are they using this as a mechanism to help destroy the West?
Well, here in the United States, the porn industry is absolutely dominated by members of a certain tribe, if you get my drift.
Sure do.
And years ago, a porn star named Ron Jeremy was Jewish. I mean, many a truth is said in jest. And he came right out. He said, you know, we Jews do porn because we hate Christ. So, but that is, you know, one more weapon in the arsenal to destroy the fabric of society, in particular the family. And this has had a disastrous impact on the family. I mean, you have to ask yourself, you know, with this 50% divorce rate in the West and a large number of these divorces, I know for sure, the coup de grace was an adulterous affair. Now, you know, extramarital affairs have existed since time immemorial. It's not something new. But what's different today, and this ties in with the sexuality and the porn, is that it's lost its stigma. People do it openly. I mean, they don't even care. Okay? So that destroys the family. The promotion of out-of-wedlock promiscuity long before marriage, I think, undermines the institution of marriage. Why buy the cow if the milk is for free, as they say? And if you look, right. If you look at the marriage rates amongst our young people today, I mean, the figure I saw, like here in America in 1970, 75% of all 30-year-olds were married and already had their first child. Today, that number is in the 20s. Okay, so very few people on a percentage basis are even bothering to get married, and then half of those that are getting divorced. So in time, what we're manufacturing here is scores of millions of children from broken homes or from homes that never formed in the first place. And you see a lot of these people now in adulthood. There's just an alienation. There's no family. There's no extended family. And hence, there's no community. And, you know, again, this is what the elites want. Just break us down into alienated little automatons who could never ever muster up the desire nor the ability to form a group and change things.
Exactly.
It's real rolling. Yeah.
It's very extraordinary how beneficial that has been, you know, for the establishment. And I think that's kind of the part of the war on men as well, in terms of the lack of the fact that they can, you know, kind of organize and get together and even recognize a threat to them, to their families, to their people, you know, to their folk, to a certain extent. I mean, what are people doing today? They're, you know, sitting at home watching Ghostbusters movies and eating Twinkies. And they're like, you know, collecting Star Wars, you know, kind of regalia and things like that. And these are like grown men who have like nothing better to do with their lives. So that's like, that's the new American male, Twinkies and Ghostbusters, you know?
And sports.
Certainly, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty sad, but it feels like it's kind of getting oversaturated though, that it's starting to lose its value really, because at some point the shock effect, you know, it's going to wear off. Do you think there's going to be a resurgence as a kind of a, you know, you've kind of seen there's people alluding to this now online in terms of what kind of the websites they set up and all that with they're taking back the word revolt and rebellion and all those kinds of things, but it's more from a you know, traditionalist kind of point of view, that it's a resurgence, that it will be popular as a way of kind of going against the establishment and the system. That's now to kind of be more traditional, right?
Well, I always feel that in the long term, that which is unnatural, you know, cannot hold. But it's the triggering mechanism for the restoration of sanity is going to entail an enormous amount of suffering. That's just the way our human natures are. And not until people are brought to their knees can they snap out of the trance and maybe still have enough left in them to turn this thing around. But it's not going to come about until there's an enormous reset, some type of economic crash, world crisis, things that have got to shake out. It's almost, in a strange sense, you almost hope for the you-know-what to hit the fan just to see what comes out of it,
yeah,
as opposed to just going along in this trance where people are comfortable, their bellies are full, and their homes are warm. But yeah, if there is to be change, it's going to be preceded by earth-shaking trauma.
Yeah, I know what you mean, though, in terms of the waiting for some kind of, you know, catastrophic, you know, change to a certain extent. That could be whatever, basically. The collapse, if that comes in the form of economy or some environmental issue or what have you. But it's also, there's also a danger in that, because that tends people to kind of sit around on their ass and waiting for something to happen, as opposed to kind of take charge and take the reins and start changing things. I mean, if it occurs, sure, I guess we have to use that opportunity to try to, you know, stabilize things a bit and kind of regain and take back what has been lost. But at the same time, I think there's no better time than now, right? Just to kind of get into it and whatever aspect we can, really start to kind of bring balance to the picture, bring sanity and be a role model for, you know, for other people in that regard. And because there's so many broken people out there today, so many psychological issues, people are depressed, they're on medications, you know, popping pills to left and right. If there is, you know, people who can represent a stability, I think that will in itself would actually attract people, right, to it, you know?
Well, yeah, that's important. And any other element of what we can do now is to do what you're doing, do what I'm doing, is plant as many seeds as we can, which,
yeah,
you know, who knows when they might germinate. But, you know, it's always heartening for me from time to time to get an email, particularly from a young person, saying, you know, I was doing some research into World War II. I stumbled across your site. This is awesome. Thank you for putting this together. And, oh, boy, does that make me feel good.
Yeah, I know.
But that's all we can do at this point. And that's my calling with this with tomatobubble.com.
Well, it's a great site. And let's kind of get into that topic now a little bit. This is one of the other main issues we want to talk about here. You know, World War II history, how many things we've been lied about, but also the bigger picture of, you know, conspiracy and the kind of the psychology behind that we've been lied to, and that it's very difficult for a lot of people to kind of see through those aspects, and particularly many of the constants that even people, let's say, within the conspiracy field, and alternative press and media and everything else, where there are hurdles along the way everywhere, and we all have them, and I have them too, and other people do, and it's difficult to see through everything, and it's easy to regurgitate and parrot things that we've been told, because you know, we might not always think about it or think that there is a deeper issue, you know, with the subject at hand, or that there is another level to the lying and everything. But what can you say about the psychology of this, and why people are so prone not to look at certain material, and specifically, I guess, when it comes to things like World War II and what happened there, and kind of a revising of that history, and trying to, you know, sort that out basically, and realize that we're in a world today, a post World War II world that were won by the Allies, and today we're living in that environment. What you see in the world today is a product of that, right?
Oh yeah, I mean, I like to refer to World War II not really as a war, but if you put it in a broad, really broad historical context, it was a battle. It was a pivotal battle in the age-old war between Judea and Europa, and unfortunately, we lost. But as to your point about the psychology, that's something I could definitely relate to. When I stepped out of fantasy land about 10, 15 years ago, I first began taking my first baby steps out. Even being aware of the fact that I had been lied to and brainwashed, I still had psychological roadblocks to overcome. At every new level, you start telling yourself, no, this can't be true. And you're looking for an alternative explanation to confirm the belief that was shoved down your throat since you were a child. So it takes a while, even, and I've always considered myself a free thinker. I mean, I did come out of that fake world, but not instantly. Now, so you could imagine what it's like for some of our weaker-minded countrymen when they're confronted with this stuff. Now, I have a piece on my updates page at tomatobubble.com on about the movie Planet of the Apes. I don't know if you've seen it.
What, the new one or something?
The new movie.
Yeah, the new one. No, I haven't seen that. I've seen the older ones. The old one is pretty good. The classic, of course, with
Charlton Heston.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's great. Now, but I didn't like the new ones. Yeah.
This was in theaters a couple of months ago. But in particular, what I wrote about was a scene in the film in which the leader of the apes, Caesar, he's overthrown by another ape who wants to start a war with the humans. And in order to start the war, this ape shoots Caesar and then blames it on the humans. So there's a false flag there. But later on, we learn that Caesar has survived. And his son is urging him. He says, you have to go into the city. The apes are making war with the humans. Show yourself to the apes. Explain what happened. And we'll stop this. And Caesar explains to his son. He said, no, Caesar is weak now. He was recovering from his wound. Ape will only follow strong. And, you know, that's very insightful observation there. And it gives us an understanding of our own natures. Humans only follow the strong. Red Ice Radio is not ABC or the New York Times. Tomatobubble.com is not NBC or the Washington Post. We don't have that so-called stature and status and circulation. We're not strong. So it doesn't matter how truthful and logical we present the case.
Yeah.
People only follow strong.
Yeah.
And strong is New York Times, ABC, CBS, CNN, BBC, whatever the major stations are in Sweden, and so on. So that's really at the root of everything. I mean, partially it's because people do not want to accept those things which are unpleasant. Yet at the same time, if the New York Times tomorrow was to proclaim, for example, that, oh, the Holocaust was a hoax after all, people would convert instantly.
Do you think so? Yeah.
Well, maybe not instantly. actually, when the Times wants to sell some BS, some heavy-duty BS, I track the paper every day. I actually do a daily piece called The Anti-New York Times. but the way they'll do it is they'll do it subtly. They'll raise a few questions, and then they'll turn up the heat. So even when they sell a big scam, it takes the Times 1 to 2 weeks to to get the full throttle falsehood.
Mm-hmm.
But my point is this: if the strong were to do an about face on any topic, be it 9/11, World War II, the Holocaust, give it a week or two, and the public would follow. So that's the predicament we're up against. That's the reality. People only follow the strong.
So it's a question of leadership, really, and authority, and also kind of, you know, posing and having that in place. Because, I mean, let's face it, they have, well, in some cases, anyway, they have, you know, good looking presenters, right? Or, you know, it's very flashy and everything. They're playing on all the kind of psychological buttons, really. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, whatever. I think that's something, if that's what you have to use to speak to people, then why not? But at the same time, if you had the truth on your side, it would be even more that powerful. But fortunately, we're kind of in a situation now when old media really is dying and crumbling. And we've seen a number of other, I think, new media, but still, you know, kind of a heavily funded with the backdrop. Some of these websites, it's just kind of, you know, pop up out of nowhere. They're huge within a year or two, massive funding behind them. And they kind of pose as new media, but they're still very much kind of a part of the establishment, because they know people are also, you know, marketing people know this. People are instinctively suspicious. They don't, you know, they look at it with a skeptical eye to a certain extent, unless, of course, there's a big traumatic event where they get shocked, like 9/11 or something like that. Then they bow down to like sheep right away and basically tell us what happened. And yes, sir, we're going to believe that now, you know. So it's
it's
different components there to it, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you know, Hitler wrote about this in Mein Kampf, about people's vulnerability to the small lies. I mean, to the big lies, even though they you can't fool them with the small lies. You'll see this. I mean, most people instinctively do not take what politicians say at face value, nor even the news at times. But if there's a really big event, then all of a sudden those sources become, you know, holy writ.
Yeah. Later here in the second hour, I want to talk a little bit more about World War II, your view on this, how you stumbled into a lot of this material, what you found along the way. You've written about that. You have another kind of... It's called Hitler Visits Oprah. It's available as a book and an ebook and everything else. I want to talk a little bit about what some of the content therein is and how you approach that particular subject and why you wanted to write on it and whatnot. But I wanted to talk a little bit more about some of the other books as well you have out there, Mike, before we kind of take a break, and let our listeners know, you know, what they can find on the website a little bit more and how they can pick up copies of your book that you have available there.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I would say about 80% of the site's content is free of charge, but I do have special feature items. These books, they're available in PDF format, and some of them are also available in hard copy format. You touched upon my personal favorite, the one that's near and dear to my heart, which is Hitler Visits Oprah. There's also The Bad War, which covers most of the same topics. It's about World War II. It's just Hitler Visits Oprah is just a bit more entertaining and creative, yet it's utterly serious history, make no mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Then perhaps the flagship piece of the site, I guess my biggest undertaking, would be the book entitled NWO Forbidden History, The Epic Timeline of the New World Order, 1763 to 2013. That's 256 pages, 200 illustrations. And it's a summary of all the major events dating back to the founding of the Illuminati, the Rothschild family in the 1770s. And you can just follow it decade by decade. I call it a crash PhD course in conspiratorial studies. And all of my works are heavily illustrated. And there's a reason for that. I believe the old adage, a picture's worth a thousand words. And it's been proven, actually, that when people combine an image with the words, the information really makes an impact. So all of my books are heavily illustrated, took really awesome illustrations that just fit the story very well. What else do I have? Well, then I have the Putin book, which came out earlier this year. It was originally titled The Talented Mr. Putin. I reissued it with a new cover called The War Against Putin. And I recently come out with The God of Logic, a deductive debunking of unscientific atheism. in which I examine some of the holes in traditional Darwinian theory and the manner in which the globalists latched on to the theory and heavily promoted it. So that's five books that are available in paperback. And then there's other items that are pay-per-view email PDFs. But nonetheless, the majority of the content is free to the reader.
All right, very good. Check out the books, The God of Logic, The War Against Putin, and then New World Order Forbidden Histories, 1763 to 2013, Hitler Visits Oprah, and also The Bad War. The website is tomatobubble.com. Go on over there, check it out, and see if you like some of the writings there. We're going to take a short break here, then, Mike. Stay with us. We'll be right back with more, and we'll pick this up in the second hour. Alright folks, hope you're ready for a second hour coming up here with Mike King, a very interesting one as we proceed to discuss World War II and why it's important in the context of current issues. We discuss the resistance to the New World Order and what that really means. We talk about Judea when they declared war on Germany, and also England's King George, who had his speechwriters pen his speech 9 days before England invaded Germany. In other words, they knew beforehand that they were going to attack. And, of course, this was all allegedly in response to the invasion, the German invasion of Poland. So there's a lot of things amiss in that story. We discuss the predatory ruling class and lies that exists around any war in order to demonize your enemy, to turn them into Satan incarnate. You can, of course, think about the stories that we heard about babies being thrown out of incubators or weapons of mass destruction, and even the anthrax that was traced back to the U.S. military. We talk about mind weapons or weaponized ideas in order to create chaos and a corrosive element within society. So at what point should and would a government protect itself if the threat was real and not false flags? We discuss degenerate art and how Stalin prepared a surprise attack on Germany in 1941, and that it was this intelligence that launched Operation Redbeard, or Barbarossa, as people know it as. So, lots more interesting coming up. I hope you join us in the second hour. We do spare you from commercial interruptions and website ads. We are listener-supported, and you can catch the next hour and, of course, all our previous programs on redicemembers.com. Head on over there and sign up for a membership and get aboard. We have a lot of good stuff for you right there. Coming up, we have Kevin and Benny from JoyCamp. We have Tom Goodridge, John DeNugent, Frank Salter, Kai Murrells, Matthew Tate, and many more. Stay with us. We'll be right back with Mike King. Thank you for listening.